Welcome to EI Talks, the podcast that takes ideas seriously. I'm Paul Lay, Senior Editor at Engelsberg Ideas, and I'm joined by Alistair Benn, Deputy Editor of EI. And today we're here to talk about tourism, past, present and future. I can safely say that having commuted into London today, tourism is back en masse with all the usual irritations. Tourists standing on the left on the underground escalators, big queues at the British Museum. But at least London is cool, in every sense, of course, which can't be said for mainland Europe, or great swathes of mainland Europe, where temperatures of 46 degrees have been reached in Spain and Italy. There are wildfires in Greece, even in the Swiss Alps. And further afield, I discovered that Los Angeles has a chief heat officer. Nothing to do, Alistair, with your favourite LA film. So what are the implications? Tourist numbers are rising fast, seemingly everywhere post-lockdown. And this has major implications, potentially for the future of our planet.
Yes, and I'm slightly worried about my own summer holiday plans. I'm going to Italy and to Istanbul in August, so I may sort of shrivel or be burnt to a crisp. I feel ambivalent about tourists in London, partly because they seem to all collect like sort of fruit flies around mangoes around Westminster Bridge, which I cycle over to get to work. And I don't understand what the attraction of Westminster Bridge is. I guess it's got a kind of a nice view of the Thames, but then the Thames is a sort of not very... London has an absolutely appalling riverfront. It just doesn't exist. It's not like going to the Seine. You look down, you see the Musée d'Orsay floating in almost as if in midair, and the islands, and it's so beautiful. The Thames, most of the time, looks pretty shabby. But no, just about every tourist in the land takes photos of themselves on Westminster Bridge with Parliament. And when I'm cycling over, I sort of shout, oi, and buzz my bell on my bicycle. And so my interaction with tourists of late has not been a happy one. And I guess what I'm getting at is that there, I guess depending on your view, there are good tourists and bad tourists.
You're doing nothing to sell Britain to the tourists there. I walk over Westminster Bridge just about every day. And I think if you want to understand what tourists see there, you have to look at it with eyes anew as though you're seeing it for the first time. And I think that's always the most interesting thing there, is that the appeal of Westminster Bridge, all the London bridges, is you get that incredible vista. You really do get something like 1,000 years of history there, all the way from St. Paul's right down to the Houses of Parliament and beyond. And you have the imagination of what the Thames has been, is. It's still that same river that flows through that great city. And I mean, I think in terms of that, it is a genuinely global city. People will want to be there. It's not only that, it's equidistant between North America and the rest of Europe. It's the great gateway to Europe for much of the world as well. And of course, we can't ignore the imperial past as well that brings so many people here. And of course, so many people have a connection here as well. But let me just give you some statistics about tourism, because I think it's quite important. It's worth something like global tourism. And I think this is an important thing, is that tourism is now genuinely global. It's not just a few wealthy people who are enjoying it now. Since we've had globalization, it's become a genuinely global industry, and it's worth something like $6 trillion. There are something like 255 million people's livelihoods who depend on it, some who depend on it wholly. And it also comes with the downside. 8% of global emissions, it may be as much as that, are caused by tourism. We're seeing coral reefs, forests, savannas threatened by this. And I think we're also seeing that there's a change in the nature of tourism potentially on its way, particularly when we come to think of the transformation of the beach holiday. There are different kinds of tourism. The beach holiday may not be viable for that much longer in Europe. We don't know. And people are shifting towards the mountains. They're looking at different locations. They're looking north into Scandinavia, into the UK and Ireland, northern Spain, places like that. Winter sports are much less viable in Europe than they were. Insufficient snowfall. So you'll see that former skiing destinations are offering themselves as year-round destinations. And so there's coastal tourism, rising sea levels. There's all kinds of problems there. And yet, I can't see there being any real challenge to tourism at all, because there is this essential need for people to travel, to seek new experiences, to authenticate their experience. We can read about these places, we can see these places, we have the ability on something like Google Maps and Google Earth to just almost be in these places, and we've got the virtual reality nature, but there's nothing quite like the authentic, and in a world perhaps devoted to the virtual, that becomes even more valuable.
But there's a double edge, isn't it? I mean, places that become very popular, it becomes much, much harder to find that authenticity, to empty out your perceptions and let the kind of free association of your kind of personal history, culture, and everything come together. I'm thinking really of Amsterdam when I think of a place which is, for British people, full of association. You know, the Dutch masters, the Dutch golden age. You know, we're obsessed with their art. It's a place that's not very far away. Some of the landscapes are very familiar because in Holland in general, because they're just over the way from...
Well, there's a strong East Anglian connection.
Exactly. And in fact, much of East Anglia resembles Holland. Mm. I mean, chicken and egg. But when you go to Amsterdam now, and I guess it's about maybe seeing it with what hat you've got on, or what eyes you're seeing it with. Because I went when I was about 10 years old with my family. And to me, I remember it was one of my favourites sort of family holidays, because it felt recognisable. You know, you could almost see the burghers skating around on the ice, and you know, going to all the museums and these beautiful townhouses looking over frozen canals. But then I went back last summer, and I don't know whether it's just because we went to different places, but it, to me, felt like a sort of hellish place, full of, without being too snobbish, sort of lagerlouts, you know, drunkenly drifting from fleshpot to fleshpot, and tat everywhere, and rubbish, and it felt like a town centre in the UK on a Friday night. I'd gone to a place expecting to form new impressions, and I just ended up going back to where I didn't want to be. So that's a kind of, you know, a long-winded way of saying that, again, coming back to that idea, you know, that there's clearly good tourism which respects the place you're going to, and to some extent opens yourself up to the impressions that place is about to give you. And there is a tourism that has become very common, which is expects to impose itself on the place and expects the people who live there to meet your assumptions about what you think constitutes a quote-unquote holiday.
Yeah, that's right. It's been described as a moral holiday. I think that's actually a Dutch phrase. This moral holiday, this idea that you leave behind the civilizing tendencies that you have at home, and you sort of let it all hang out. And Amsterdam's become that kind of place in the popular idea of Amsterdam, which is a great sadness, because I've always had this tremendous ambivalence towards Amsterdam being this kind of party city, this stag night destination, because for me, I want to go to the Rijksmuseum, I want to see the several small galleries, it's home to the Concertgebouw, which is arguably the finest musical venue in the whole of Europe, magnificent, specific classical music tradition that it has. It has wonderful bars, it has wonderful places, but it has this seedy element that I think Amsterdamers have woken up to. And they, in fact, now have a campaign called Stay Away. And I think this has been particularly targeted at the British stagnite tradition of going to Amsterdam, because as you say, it's so close, it's so easy to get to Amsterdam from Britain as it is from all kinds of parts of the Europe. And they want to break that. They want to break that cycle of misbehaviour, of ill behaviour, of this kind of hedonism, and focus on the things that really Amsterdam should be renowned for, its Rembrandts, the concert, all that wonderful stuff. And I wonder if this has something to do with lockdown, people thinking again about what their cities should be. There was a kind of attempt to reconsider cities, because there are places that are much worse off in Europe even than Amsterdam. And I think in particular of a very, very extreme case of Barcelona, where I think the last time visitor numbers were measured in Barcelona, it was approaching something like 10 million visitors. And that didn't even include the Airbnb. And this is a massive problem for a city like Barcelona in terms of not only the unpleasant experience that the locals have placed on them, but also who wants, what tourist wants to be in this overcrowded place. We've seen cities like Dubrovnik, for example, have quotas on tourists. And of course, then there's the classic case, one of the oldest tourist cities of all, Venice, which now has something like the same number of visitors as it has actually the population there at any one particular moment. They ban cruise ships, for example. So there is a problem. And I think there's also a problem in terms of the way we see, the way a tourist sees a city and the way they observe a city. I mean, you've alluded to that when you talk about the way tourists behave in London.
But the frontier of high-status tourism now is things like going in submarines to the bottom of the ocean.
Yes,
and going to space.
Yeah.
And potentially even war tourism, which is a very nasty but modern phenomenon of people paying to I think it was a feature of the Balkan Wars where people would pay to go and witness the siege of Sarajevo, or even to lob a few pot shots, and you know, they'd spend a day. So yeah, the kind of frontier of that kind of extreme tourism takes you away from other human beings and takes you into very extreme sort of zones of nature and all the rest. But I guess that's not really what we're talking about.
Yes, I can't say it appeals to me. Greg,
no, it's
being either
doesn't.
Under the sea or in deepest space, I think I might pass on those.
I think it. Well, coming from Scotland, I think it. Tourism. I always think about that scene in Trainspotting where the American walks into an absolute sort of dive pub that all the characters go to and sort of goes, you know, I'm here for the fringe. Where are we? You know, where's the fringe or something like that. So I apologise, listeners, for my appalling an accent. And what they obviously, you know, Rent and the rest, they beat him up. And I think Scotland has a. There's another apocryphal story that someone once came across an American tourist in the west of Scotland urinating on the grave of a factor employed by the Duke of Sutherland, quite a notorious factor who in the era of the Highland Clearances. And this American tourist believed himself to be related to one of the people who had been cleared by this factor from their ancestral territories and sent across the sea to the New World. As someone, I find that kind of diaspora interest in Scottishness, again, rather double-edged. You know, it's nice that people are interested in Scotland, and America is actually a huge export market for Scotland in terms of just stuff, you know, whiskey, salmon, all that. It's big money.
Well, I mean, I think if you're talking about tourists imposing a kind of faux heritage of diaspora, then if you think Scotland's got it bad, try Ireland. I mean, Joe Biden's your classic sort of uncomprehending tourist there, I think, in terms of his associations. He likes to draw on that. But I think that's an interesting shift because in the past, perhaps an American would wish to discover some kind of roots with aristocracy or something like that. And remember, during the 19th century, there was a great intermarriage between the British aristocracy and American wealth. I mean, Winston Churchill was a classic example of that, for example. But now, that diaspora is often more likely to seek or to want a kind of victimhood of being the oppressed who've emerged, risen like a phoenix from the ashes there. So there's that stuff. There's that kind of authenticity that's being sought again. And that's people who have some connection, who've presumably done some kind of work on that background. But having been to places like, say, India, which is a very, very different culture, I have been there and wondered, how much am I really understanding here? How much am I really absorbing in anything that's beyond? I mean, it's difficult enough, even in somewhere like continental Europe. Does one speak the language, for example? Does one have any comprehension of the language? There is so much that cannot be understood on just these whistle-stop visits. One has to really immerse oneself in a culture to really understand it. And that's a lifetime's work. It's very, very difficult. I mean, if there's two countries that I know reasonably well, they would be Germany and Italy. But I still feel like a complete novice and a complete fool in terms of really comprehending those countries. So how much more difficult is someone like, say, India or Japan or Malaysia or somewhere to comprehend in that way? And I saw this once turning the tables. I was in Munich a few years ago, not many years ago, and someone took me along to an incredibly traditional conservative Catholic church there. The service was entirely in Latin. There was a packed, packed congregation, actually quite youthful. There were young women wearing mantillas, which you rarely see. It was obvious, extremely devout, devotional, making a statement of sort. And a couple of young Korean tourists came in. And what was striking about this was the congregation was very, very formally dressed. And two tourists came in, and I'm not being snobbish about this. I was there for anthropological purposes as well. I'm not a Catholic. I was not a worshipper. I was just watching it. But I knew enough about Catholic practices to know, you know, when to shut up and when to bear obeisance. But the two young Koreans, not through their own fault, they were just uncomprehending of it. And they started talking and taking photographs. And a kind of scene emerged that what they were seeing was a kind of form of entertainment, as tourists often do when they look on rituals, or they look on practices, exotic rituals or practices. And it was very interesting to see that table turned with Asian observers of European practices that were strange and exotic. And it made me reflect on the way I view these worlds, uncomprehending often, with, you know, with the very best intentions to try and learn and comprehend. There are limits to how much one can engage with another culture.
Yeah, and because, well, I think that comes out in the American interests in Europe, Henry James, but particularly Henry Adams, who wrote a book on, I think, with a subtitle, Travels in France, which has the title of Mont-Saint-Michel and Chartres. And he, it's sort of set up as you think, oh, this is an American chap just going to France to look at some Norman architecture, from the subtitle, Travels in France. But I really would urge anyone to read this book. He's sort of travelling in the early 20th century. And he... basically, it's a voyage of the imagination, without being too sort of cliched about it. It's, he goes to these ancient places like Mont-Saint-Michel, which have their histories around the Norman conquest, and sees them as only perhaps an American could, as a place not so much of deep history, which is just a fact, but as a site of meaning and stories and as something that our perceptions, we can evolve, we can create, you know, for a European or a French or for a Catholic worshiper, that's probably maybe not how they appear. But to him, he sees it as a kind of sea of story that he can navigate. And I think Europe has this quality that because it's so weighty with history, particularly to us in the UK, we go there and we are awed by the complexity and things around us. We can just be just overawed and that can be it. But I think that's a better thing to be than to not see anything at all, I feel everywhere I've been in Europe where tourism does feel present, whether it's Positano on the Amalfi Coast or in Prague, there's a sort of ruined quality about it. It feels like you're in no place at all. But I must say the places I've enjoyed going to most as a tourist in the last decade have been places a bit off the beaten track, particularly the Balkans. I didn't think much of Budapest when I went because it's so touristy because I was quite young, you just stick in the same places because that forms your assumptions about a place. So you think the touristy bits of the place is worth going to. But then going to places like Albania and Bosnia, which are a little bit less touristy, Sarajevo, suddenly you are opening, suddenly your kind of perceptions of the place fall away slightly. Albania, which is actually becoming very touristy now, I hope it doesn't change from the kind of very wacky, eccentric place that I went to.
It will.
Yeah, it will. It will become a bit monotone and it will lose something. I mean, I remember going to Russia about 7 years ago and going to, it was just in the summer, going to Moscow and Siberia. And again, because of the strangeness of the place, and again, that feeling, as you said, of going somewhere where I really didn't understand a lot of what I was seeing. I mean, in Moscow, you go to art galleries, you know, apart from all the art being miserable and of sort of various peasants, you know, miserably and glum-looking Orthodox priests. You know, it does feel sort of recognisable. We're going to Siberia. I went to Irkutsk and Baikal and places like that. You're forced to do that, you know, emptying of perception and letting the place actually.
And there's less of a tourist infrastructure, perhaps, as well, which is interesting.
Well,
but
zero.
I mean, and that's going far afield. But one of the interesting things about lockdown, I found, was that I rediscovered England in a way, and Britain in particular, particularly England and Wales, which I'd neglected, as we do. There's a very interesting story told by Rory Sutherland, the advertising guru, when he was at a business school class. And he asked the people there, who were a pretty affluent and well-travelled bunch, he asked them how many people had been to Machu Picchu, the great site in South America. And about half the group put their hands up. A lot of people had been to Machu Picchu. And then he then said, how many of you have been to Lincoln Cathedral? One of the great buildings of the world. Not a single one had been to Machu Picchu, despite the fact that they were in Britain. They were just a short train ride away from this, one of the glories of the world that's in a fabulous location. They just hadn't been there. And so in a way, this idea of exoticizing things means that we often miss the things that are right in front of us. And having lived in London now for something like 35 years, there are still things that I discover. But I also like that habitual kind of nature of returning to the same place over and over again and always finding new things about it. But I think there's also been a shift in Britain. I think Britain is the home of the Industrial Revolution. There's an interest in industrial heritage that is relatively new. I mean, if we think back to the origins of tourism in any modern sense, in any European sense, we think back to the Grand Tour, for example, which ostensibly was a way in which wealthy young aristos and the like would be sent on a journey south across the Alps into Italy. They would be given ostensibly a kind of classical education. They would be instructed in art and architecture in the classical forms. Of course, we shouldn't forget that just like the modern tourists as well, they also sowed their oats. This was also a moral holiday for them. So there's nothing new about what we see in places like Amsterdam and Neapia or wherever. You know, this is what young people do and have always done. It's just that there's a lot more people who can afford to do it now. And they don't concentrate so much on the classical education. In fact, they don't even bother with that smokescreen anymore.
Well, yeah, I mean, sort of bourgeois tourism also of the late 19th century and early 20th century was brilliantly anatomised by E.M. Forster and his novels about Italy, just the English middle class seeing Italy, being disappointed by Italy when they get there. there's a great scene in his first novel, Where Angels Fear to Tread, which is about one of the members of this party of English people in this small provincial Italian town. And this character is obsessed with the Italy and always going on about it. But is sort of a bit disappointed by what he finds when he gets there, and especially disappointed when he goes to the opera and finds it to be really raucous. And this is an absolutely hilarious scene where he's just having a meltdown because all the Italian public aren't really appreciating what they're watching on the stage.
Yes,
and going nuts and sort of clapping at the wrong bits.
Well, I too witnessed a very rowdy Neapolitan marriage of Figaro, I remember, and being quite shocked by it at the San Carlo in Naples. So that tradition continues. We've talked about Europe a lot because I think Europe is in many ways, at least from a British perspective, the kind of ideal tourist destination, the way in that it has an infrastructure. It has incredible diversity in what is really little more than a peninsula. But it's warming up faster than just about anywhere else in the world. There's going to be problems, both for cities, both for beach holidays, all this, that and the other. And I have been lucky enough to have grown up at a time when there really was a genuine expansion in global terms. But there's now a strong urge that people do not take long-distance flights, or at least reduce massive long-distance flights. I should say that a long-distance flight is apparently one that's more than 9,941 miles. I discovered that that's the actual definition of a long-distance flight, which is the equivalent of something like London to Bangkok. But this has enormous ramifications if this is true. I mean, I think it's going to be very, very difficult to enforce this idea that people shouldn't travel to Bangkok or South America or wherever they go. Just almost impossible. It would be very sad, that, because I think what we've had is this genuine globalisation, and there have been real downsides to globalisation. But this discovery of the world by lots and lots of people is must be a good thing, but it's going to change. Europe, I suspect, can maintain a very strong tourist industry, despite the challenges that climate change and other things may present. There's the potential of a very serious train network in Europe, which would really make a difference. I mean, from my experience, there are very good train networks in Europe. I think of Italy, I think of Switzerland, for example. There are very poor ones, the UK being one, Germany another. And so there has to be a kind of consistency of quality along there if that's to work. But that's certainly real potential, I think, within Europe. I think where is going to really be a problem for tourism is in the global south, and in particular in island nations. I mean, if we think of two that are so dependent upon tourism, the Maldives, for example, Barbados, for example, almost entirely dependent on tourism. So many people there. And I think that is where the real pain will occur if there is a reduction in tourism. And of course, these places may well disappear with rising seas. We just don't know. And that would be a catastrophe, because I don't think there's anywhere in Europe, for example, that is entirely dependent on tourism. So, for example, Amsterdam, that we've talked about, its stay away campaign is viable because, you know, Amsterdam has a great tech industry, it's got a real, you know, vibrant economics. You know, it would be the same with Munich, it would be the same with Vienna, it would be the same with London. You know, these places can survive without tourism. They can, to a certain extent, push tourists away. There are parts of this world that really cannot and will suffer immensely if that is done. Maybe that's for another programme.
Yeah.
In terms of, if you wanted to follow this Dutch idea of stay away, this idea that Amsterdam is practising, then some cities, Paris, for example, charge a tourist tax.
Yeah.
But the tourist tax is something like €5. And that's the case whether you're in a 50-euro room or you're in a 2,000-euro suite somewhere. So, I mean, it's absolutely meaningless. Manchester, I think, is the only British place that has a tourist tax. It's £1 a night. I mean, it's meaningless. No one is going to be remotely concerned about that one way or the other. So I think the very fact that tourist taxes are so low suggests that no one is really serious about this, apart from Amsterdam. Amsterdam may be a pioneer. I don't know. It's had this huge Vermeer exhibition this year that must have produced so much in terms of the coffers, both at the Rijksmuseum and the whole heritage industry there. I mean, you know, Amsterdam has been really the focus of the tourist industry this year, over this year. So even a place that takes very, very active steps to promote itself as a certain kind of tourist place, if you like, promotes quality over quantity, has a real challenge.
Yeah, and I mean, there may be, I think with the warming stuff, particularly for the UK, that may present opportunities for travel within the UK, absolutely, you know.
Yeah.
It's a tragedy that, in my view, England's seaside, for propagandistic reasons, I think, has been labelled as an unpleasant and sort of vaguely crappy.
Because it often is. I mean, let's face it.
It often is, but luxurious in that, you know.
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah. They could be transformed. I mean, you may well, you know, if I was an entrepreneur and I really took global warming seriously and I saw these shifts to the north, then you could do worse and invest in places like Hastings. You know, we've seen Margate, for example, have something of a renaissance since Tracy Emin involvement in rebranding it. And it's actually worked rather well. You know, I even thought about maybe you could rebrand St. Leonard's-on-Sea as San Leonardo del Mare would be the way. Maybe that's my business tip of the year. But there may well be that shift. One can imagine countries like Norway, Finland, Sweden, as you say, the north coast of Germany and Poland and places like that, the Baltic itself. I don't know about, you know, maybe northern Spain, certain parts of France, northern France, for example. But then you have to look at the damage that's been done in southern Europe, where tourism has been so important to the entire area. And if climate change continues as it does, that could be catastrophic for them. It's worth bearing in mind, though, I think. It's if there's, you know, what we see southern Europe, even beyond southern Europe, bake, that there are still 10 times more deaths in Europe from cold than there are from heat. At the moment, around about 20,000 people die from causes related to heat, but 200,000 die from causes related to cold. So we have challenges on every front there.
If you go to somewhere like the Costa Brava in Spain, which is where my grandparents went on their honeymoon, the photos from their honeymoon are beautiful. It's these little villas, you know, with rocks going down to the sea. little villages along dotted along the coast. I went to Costa Brava on an orchestra tour at school, and we stayed in one of these resort towns, and it was just appalling. It was the most horrible place I've ever been.
Yeah.
And I remember speaking to my grandparents about it and showing them photos and things, and they just didn't really recognise the place that they'd been to
well,
all those years ago. Just before package holidays became such a phenomenon.
The Costa Brava was the great pioneer
yeah.
of mass market tourism, of package tourism, during the 60s and 70s, just as places like Hastings, Blackpool, other British resorts were pioneers during the 19th century. And it may well be that those Spanish resorts in the mid and the south of Spain, places in Italy, places in Portugal, wherever, and Greece in particular, may go the way
yeah.
of Hastings and Margate during that time and will have to reinvent themselves because times change. And wouldn't it be extraordinary if this meant a renaissance in, as you say, British seaside resorts that have been so neglected.
Mm.
There's still extraordinary architectural infrastructure there. But it would be extraordinary, and I suppose ironic, if global warming meant that the UK and Ireland, no doubt, became a destination for the rest of Europe and indeed the world.
Yes, and I think that these places may be in some way sort of cheapened by mass tourism, but what comes after could be far worse.
Yeah,
ghost towns, places where
yeah.
no one lives at all.
Yeah, yeah.
And that could be kind of horrifying.
Yeah.
But I think with, even with the 19th century, I've no idea what the numbers were of people coming into places like Blackpool, but I imagine yeah. they were actually...
Well, in the 20th century, certainly they were huge.
Yeah, they were absolutely enormous. And yes, to be a tourist in the good sense in your own country can be a great thing. That going to a place where you've got a perception of a place, but you go with an open heart and an open mind and you let it sort of fill you up. I mean, I remember going to Blackpool a few years ago to do an intensive driving course because it is the cheapest place in the whole of the UK to do an intensive driving course.
Mm.
It's also great for driving because all the kind of estates around Blackpool, those 1950s estates with enormous wide roads.
Mm.
Anyway, that's not interesting. But I did stay in a hotel. I was put up by the company. This enormous hotel in which I was the only resident. And it was very weird. It was like being in The Shining.
Mm. Mm.
I'd come out for breakfast and there'd be like one seat in this sort of enormous breakfast room. And this was in September, so I imagine there were probably more people there in the summer. But there was also something kind of fascinating about being a place that was so emptied
yeah.
of
yeah.
people that had been full of people. So potentially, even then, maybe I was being a bit of a tourist. I was, I wanted to... It was kind of my own version of disaster tourism, to see the aftermath of a place which had been prosperous because of tourism and now just wasn't. And there's something eerie and kind of melancholic and kind of beautiful about that.
It reminds me of J.G. Ballard. And as with so much, I think everything we've discussed today has a kind of Ballardian theme to it. I mean, the clairvoyancy of the man was extraordinary. But it will be interesting to see how that pans out. But I think the one thing that we can conclude today is that tourism in the future is not going to be what it was in the past.